Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega. It's been more than 60 years since Brown versus Board of Education, a landmark ruling that determined racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. Yet many U.S. schools are still separate and unequal. Why? Well, a lot of that ongoing inequality comes back to another less famous Supreme Court case, Milliken versus Bradley. In this case, the court ruled that federal courts could not mandate desegregation across school district lines. It set up a de facto wall between urban and suburban and led to the separation of many students by race and class. This summer marks 45 years since the case. Adam Harris, a staff writer at The Atlantic, joins us to explain.
Milliken v. Bradley essentially established and kind of reaffirmed this idea of local control in education. Essentially, the case overturned a district court and court of appeals ruling, which essentially ruled that Detroit's public schools had been de jure racially segregated. And as a result, it had been both the school district as well as state officials that had created this racially segregated school district. So essentially, the courts ruled that it was the state's responsibility to help integrate these school districts, right? So it couldn't just be that homogenous school district in Detroit. It had to be all of the school districts, or most of the school districts in the Michigan area, in order to help kind of create a racially integrated school system. And that meant that it had to go across district lines, right? It had to go across school district boundaries into other school districts in order to create an integrated education system. But the Supreme Court overturns that ruling and says, hey, you know, local control is kind of the root of our education system. And where there was a constitutional violation in Detroit, yes, those other school systems, they haven't necessarily proved outright that there was a de jure reason why they should be penalized for something that's going on in Detroit. So on top of kind of reinforcing this idea of local control, it kind of created and cemented this idea that school district boundaries are kind of binding and they can't be casually ignored, as they put it, as a mere administrative convenience.
So how are we seeing the effects of this ruling today?
In the last decade, in the last two decades or so, we've seen a resegregation of public schools, and it's happening in a couple of different ways. So in one way, it could be through micro-districting, as we've seen in places like Connecticut or New Jersey, where you have these very small districts that surround more majority-minority school district. And then in the South, you've seen things like school district secessions. You're seeing this effort to break away and even create their own city so that they can create their own school district. So as there have been these secessions for ostensibly the purposes of isolating that tax base to say that we want our tax dollars to go towards the best education for our children, to go towards the better public services in our community, as that's happened, it's kind of limited what the federal government can do in terms of integrating those school districts, because as Milliken v. Bradley set out, you can't cross those district lines, at least at a federal level. The federal government can't force those districts to kind of do an inter-district integration.
But this is in the 70s. By this point, are we seeing sort of an exhaustion or a pushback against what had happened during the civil rights era?
We are starting to see a pushback against, as you probably know, and it's kind of during this era of white flight, right, where you'll see white people moving out of cities as the schools are racially integrating into areas that are a little bit more isolated, where they can have more control over their schools. So it's kind of during this era of white flight, but you're also on the other side seeing a pushback against some of these rulings that's kind of saying that by implementing these restrictions to these civil rights laws and to these civil rights rulings, you're kind of limiting the gains of that civil rights era.
So let's hear a little more on that front. What was the response from the public and lawmakers after this was handed down from the Supreme Court?
The response from lawmakers was essentially that, well, this is what the court has decided. We can't cross these district boundaries. We can try to make things more equal within those district boundaries. But with white flight, with people not living near each other, it kind of changed the face of what education is and could be. So when people say that busing failed, it didn't necessarily fail as much as it was kind of hobbled by some of these rulings and by lawmakers who were essentially arguing that our hands are tied. They had ended up using Milliken to say that the federal government government doesn't have as much of a role in school desegregation as it may have before.
Why do you think there is so much resistance to this?
A lot of that is people essentially saying that, well, I want my children to go to the best school, which of course a lot of people understand now is incredibly coded language. The resources have always historically followed white students in our education system. That's just kind of one of the realities of America's education system. What that ends up lending itself to in progressive places like New York is you'll have these really high value areas with really great schools, and then you'll have these really poor communities that have schools that aren't as great because people want to move to a good school district to send their kids to the good school, as opposed to thinking about, okay, what is best for the population writ large? What is best for everyone's kids?
It's not just that schools today are still segregated, but also unequal in terms of resources. What impact has Milken had on school funding?
Essentially, what that has done is created these little pockets of wealth that surround less well-off school districts. So a recent EdBuild report basically found that there are, you know, more than 900 of these school districts that are racially isolated as well as wealth isolated. So compared to the district next door, which might be whiter, which might be wealthier, these districts have less resources and they have more minority students. And essentially what the legacy of Milken is there is that the federal government is going to be limited in what it can do in terms of remedying that disparity.
How does Milken actually translate into the classroom?
Of course, it can translate into things like older books, the buildings that can't be repaired as easily, less money for school counselors or paid paraprofessionals. There are very kind of practical things that students might need in order to be successful, whether that's college counselors or an active nurse at the school, that may end up falling by the wayside because they're receiving less money per student.
If we aren't able to address how school districts are drawn, are there other ways to counteract the damages brought by Milken v. Bradley?
There are. In a recent EdBuild report, they pointed to a couple of different ways to kind of counteract this. That yes, while the federal government's hands might be tied in ways by Milken v. Bradley, at a state level, at a district level, at a county level, things could be different. You can take these local property taxes and you can pool them at the county level as opposed to pooling them at the school district level, which means that perhaps they get more equitably distributed. Or maybe even pool them at the state level so that it's, we live in the state of Texas, so our tax dollars are getting distributed evenly to school districts across the state of Texas as the school districts need them.
Do you think that this has legs and this is really going to be at the heart of the 2020 election, or that it's just beyond the appetite of the American public?
One of the interesting things is that as the busing conversation kind of bubbled up to the fore after Senator Harris went on the offensive against Senator Biden and his record, there was an interesting thing that kind of got left behind. And that was essentially this conversation that we're having about how public schools are funded. In the conversation about busing, we spent a lot of time in how it played out in the 70s, how it played out in the 80s, and we spent less time on what are some of the ways that schools could be practically desegregated now, or that schools could be made more equitable now. Several of the campaigns will mention, well, we need to reform this emphasis that we place on local property tax dollars in our education system. But in terms of practical plans on how that would look or what that looks like, the details were few and far between.
Adam Harris is a staff writer for The Atlantic. Adam, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.